Central Oklahoma. She really rocks. I worked at the last session here. She's incredible. Right. Ask her a lot of questions. Give her a hard time. But she can handle it. She'll be with you all the time.
Pay the guilt for it.
Yeah, you know.
Just start bossing around and talking. So how many of you are big dissad debaters? What's nothing better than that nuclear war at the end of the debate? Alright? How many of you aren't so fond of that and would prefer to talk about the other part of the resolution that is more philosophical in nature, the critique debate? Anybody? About half and half. And this is a good topic, I think, because it accommodates everybody's needs. There's a lot of big relations, nuclear war type impact. You know, you've got Russia, you've got China, you've got internal political instability in a lot of countries that potentially possess nuclear weapons. You know, there's lots of good impact grounds. But on the other hand, there's really good critique grounds on this topic also. And so it kind of meets everybody's needs. But the purpose of this lecture is just to give you a brief overview, and I say brief, I mean brief, because I've talked about a lot of different critiques during this lecture. Just a brief overview of some critiques that are probably going to be run on this year's topic. And the first one is the one that is most on Facebook applicable, and it's a critique called shunning. Did any of you speak to Southeast Asia security system topic? Anybody? Yeah, shunning was a really big critique on that topic. And the whole thesis behind the shunning critique is based on back in the apartheid era, South Africa, when we and a lot of the global community put sanctions on South Africa because of apartheid and because of the racism that was inherent within their political system. And the people who started writing the card talking about shunning, which he was based on, basically made the argument why we ought to, as a global community, have sanctions on South Africa, because what they were doing was so morally reprehensible that it was necessary for us not to associate with that particular country, and that we needed to take a moral stance and not associate with them. So, obviously, this is directly applicable to what's happening on the topic, and the topic says you have to lift all or nearly all economic sanctions against a common country. And so what that means is that shunning becomes a very good negative argument, because it says, well, we're doing the status quo is good, we should not be interacting with them, just on base, straight up about as clean a link to a critique as you're ever going to get, is this your topic of shunning. And the thesis behind shunning is really fairly simple. And it's, I mean, the essence is a little bit more complex, but if you just look at what it basically means, it just says they're mean, they're nasty, they're not nice, we should not associate with them. I mean, functionally, all he really said. But the idea behind it is it's based on a damn logical, philosophical assumption. And deontology is just a fancy philosophical term that means, well, you should look at things based on your means, not necessarily on the end. So you should have a moral framework in which some things are just absolutely right and some things are just absolutely wrong, regardless of the consequences of those actions. So it says things like, racism is always wrong, so anything that might affect racism should be rejected. Even if it causes something bad to happen, on a deontological level, you can still reject it. And so the shunning critique is based very solidly on the deontological framework of what they're doing, what those countries are doing is bad. They're evil and liars for whatever they do, and as a result of that, we have a moral obligation not to interact with those people, to trade with them, to get any gain or benefit from interacting with them. Does that make sense to everybody? Any questions? I like being interactive, and I know it's really hard in this large of an audience, but if you have questions or if you have comments, or if you have a different take on the position that I'm talking about, feel free to raise your hand and interject. Are you raising your hand back there? Okay. Yeah, well, what I mean by based on is that the person who wrote the main shunning book was written by a person who was defending our policies against South Africa during the era of apartheid when we had economic sanctions on the country. And there were a lot of people who said at that point that sanctions were bad because all it really did was hurt all the black people because they were the ones who, you know, got hurt the most by the sanctions because they were the poorest part of the population. And this book is written as a just, no, excuse me, what the South African government was doing is so absolutely horrible. We have a moral obligation not to associate with them, even if there are bad consequences as a result of it. So, all the critiques debaters in this room, do you think this critique is consistent with any other critiques that you're likely to hear on the topic? Now, let's just do a straw poll first before I start going into these. How many of you are familiar with Reconstruction? Okay, a lot of you are familiar with it. How about realism? Few of you. How about the Feminist Critique of International Relations? Okay, so you've got most of you have at least heard of some of these. I'll talk about all of them, but most of you raised your hand on threat construction. Can you run some shoving threat construction together, do you think? I heard yes. Why?
Because the United States stand on what was considered an act of war. You can economically create an act of war, therefore, by shunning, not allowing
so you can't run them together, can you? Right? Well, okay, unless I just do this at the end after I go through all of them, I'm sorry, I'm doing this backwards, getting ahead of myself. The next critique that I will talk about is threat construction, and then we'll go back and have this discussion after I talk about threat construction for those of you who did not raise your hand. Threat construction is based on kind of a postmodern idea, and it's based on this notion that in the post-Cold War world, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union, that's all over, the big, you know, powerful relationship between the United States and Russia is gone. And the argument that people who write threat construction literature basically make is that we're in this era where we are the sole superpower in the world. You know, pretty much the United States is the big bad. Nobody can really counter us on a real big level or a real, you know, level that's really threatening to us. But the threat construction people argue is that because of that, and because we have a foreign policy that's been driven by this assumption that there's an enemy that we need to counteract, and that a lot of our military spending and a lot of our foreign policy objections, in order to carry those out and have people accept them, that we need to have some sort of threat in order to rally around. So we say, you, North Korea, you're a rogue state, you're evil, you're nasty. So then, what can we do? We can deploy troops in South Korea, keep our troops there, justify it, keep our troops in Asia, and it justifies doing all of these things that we did throughout the entirety of the Cold War. And what they argue is that when we do that, when we arbitrarily say somebody's a threat when they're really not, that it causes a set of actions and reactions that really turn people into a threat, or that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the idea is that when I say, North Korea, you're a threat to me, and even though they're really not at the very beginning, then we do things like, we maintain troop presence in Asia. We do things like have sanctions against the country. We do things like have militarized practices near the DMZ or the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. All of those things then cause North Korea to look at that and say, hey, wait a minute, they're about ready to trounce on us. We're just this poor, you know, relatively poor, small country, and here we've got the biggest badass in the world who's coming after us. And that causes then North Korea to respond in a certain way, which is likely to be hostile to us, which then feeds our mindset that they are a threat to us. And so you have this action-reaction cycle in which, if we would have just left them alone to start with, they wouldn't have been a threat. But because of our actions, that in their reaction to our actions, it becomes a cycle, a spiral, where then we turn into some level of conflict between the two countries or between the two areas. And so reconstruction on this topic, in a lot of ways, a lot of you are probably thinking, well, we're removing sanctions, we're engaging, we're trying to be nice to these countries, right? So was that on base terms reconstruction? The question that you ask. And on base, yes, it probably does at some level turn part of a link to threat construction. However, there are a multiplicity of links into threat construction within the literature that still allows threat construction to be a very viable argument on this topic. And one of the things that Susan was kind of joking about this morning when he had his introduction when he talked to you all was that what does constructive engagement mean? There's no policy support for it. It's not in the literature. Ooh, you know, when he made that joke about shifting. And so part of the deal with this particular topic is what does constructive engagement mean? And there's really only one exemplar in which we as a nation have labeled a policy action as constructive. So, or one exemplar of what constructive engagement is based on a relationship in which we assume that the person that we're having the relationship with is still a threat. Right? Because for the most part, we have relations with China China, but every year their MFN has to be renewed. There's always a stage 5 where we say they're nasty, evil human rights abusers, they're that whole espionage thing with the cops support this year, they're stealing our nuclear weapons, they're now threatening to have a neutron bomb when Taiwan says, ooh, maybe we might want some independence. So we still assume within our relationship with China that they are a threat. The Clinton's policy proposal and his justification for the entire policy was, yes, they are a threat, but the best way in order to bring them into our fold, to make them more like us, make them nicer, make them not a threat, is to have this policy of, you know, quote-unquote, constructive engagement, in which we trade with them, in which we, you know, allow some technology exports to them that we might not allow to some other countries, in order to make them more like us, to make them less of a threat. But the idea behind that whole concept of constructive engagement within the China question, which is the only real example we have of constructive engagement, is that they're still a threat. And the reason we're constructively engaging them is to help reduce that level of a threat. So there's still a pretty good link into it on the level of just that we're doing this in order to make them not quite as much of a threat as they were before, or to get them to do what we want. So there's definitely links in threat construction in that way. So it becomes a very interesting debate because there's very good links saying sanctions and the use of sanctions help create this threat or create this other that they'll be then respond to. And so it'll be an interesting debate this year about whether the link or the link turns better. It's not as nearly a clear link as the shunning critique is, but it's still a very viable option. And the thing about threat construction is that if you're a person who likes to run critiques, there's so many different levels of links into the threat construction debate that if you do good research on it and you get deep on it, it doesn't matter if they're going to have their well, we decrease sanctions turns to it. You're still probably going to have so many levels of links into it that it's not going to matter quite as much. Now, back to what I was saying before, which I shouldn't have done at that point, which is, can you run shunning and threat construction together?
No, because, yeah, a threat construction is to say that we would, well, what a sanction is essentially designed to counter a threat on a basis. So our instructors would say that we should do things like remove sanctions, but removing those sanctions would cause interaction with another country, which some of the actions are trying to avoid injury more.
Right. And a lot of the language used within the threat construction literature is this whole notion of creating the other. You know, there's somebody who's different from us, that's a threat to us, who looks distinct from us, you know, here's us, here's this big black line, and here's this other. And the whole idea of sanctions really is making somebody else the other, right? You know, because it really is based on this whole notion of shame and guilt, and, you know, we will punish you because you're not like us. So that's the classic otherization. So shunning and threat construction probably would not be the best combination of critiques to run together, just because the whole notion and the philosophical assumptions behind shunning pretty much is the creation of an other, which gives you the link into threat construction, which is something that you want to think about when you're deciding what critiques you want to run and what you can run together. The other thing I wanted to say about threat construction is that I think this topic also really lends itself to kind of critiquing on the affirmative. And it's been done some in the past, but like I came from Alabama a couple of years ago on the Southeast Asia topic. All they ran all year was a feminist critique of our military policies as an affirmative case. And I think this particular topic allows that sort of case again to happen. And I think threat construction is one of the critiques that you could potentially run on the affirmative as a critique of the current system. And so then it's because there are tons of links into the whole sanctions level of the debate that say that the use of sanctions is the otherization, it is the creating of a threat. So there's a potential that you can define that constructive engagement really isn't defined very well in the literature as moving away from this notion of threat construction and claim that as an affirmative case area. The third critique that I wanted to talk about is feminist international relations theory. And this is a very substantial branch within the whole field of international relations. And a lot of people, especially a lot of women, but it's not all women who write the feminist international theory argument, but their basic argument is that the way we have conducted foreign policy in the past is mired within the patriarchal framework. What you expect it to say, right? And the idea behind it is that foreign policy, as it's been traditionally handled within the Western world, is very much a kind of a one-upmanship type situation in which, and I use the word one-up man specifically for a reason, but it is that this notion that there always has to be a dominant place. Right, because the whole balance of power theory, real politics, that foreign relations have been based on for the last several hundred years, is this notion that there is a power. And that power gets to control the world. It's a very dominant, hierarchical system of power relations. So we, as the United States, we're the big, bad kids on the block, you know, the global bully, and we get to tell the rest of the world what we want them to do, how we want them to do it, when they're going to do it. And so the feminist international relations theory said, you know, this might not be the healthiest way to conduct foreign policy. Because what happens when you, as a dominant person, just beat up on everybody else around you? They tend not to like you very much. They now have this reason where they might want to oppose you. You know, create this system in which there's hostility and conflict happening all the time, and we should do it that way. So a lot of what they argue is that instead of a very confrontational foreign policy system, that there needs to be more of a cooperative foreign policy system, that maybe negotiations and things like that would be a better option, and not a negotiation in which there's a winner, which is the type of negotiations that tend to happen right now, are that, you know, we go in, we negotiate, but ultimately we have, as the United States, our goal at the end, and which is not saying the goals are bad, but we tend to force through negotiations, and things appear to be compromised, and they tend to be agreed upon settlements, but in reality, they're really not. It's what we want, and because we have more power within the system, we can get other people to do what we want them to do, and make them almost agree with it, and make them do it, when they may not really want them, because there's the unequitable power relationship that exists. So the theory is that we need to change the way we use foreign policy. And one of the big advocates is a person named Hickman. And her argument, and a lot of the like voting issues had cards, she loved those types of cards, and she makes arguments like, it's really hard to conceive of a world in which we don't function the way we do now. Because we've been doing it for so long that when I say maybe we should have, you know, more negotiations, true negotiations, more decision-making by consensus than what we have now, people say things like, well, look at the United Nations. The General Assembly can't agree on anything, you know. There's no way to do that. And so Hickman argues that once we make this transition to a different type of foreign policy, that new ways of viewing things will be allowed. And that's a really good source because a lot of critiques, when you are critiqued, a lot of times, you know, one of the arguments against it is no alternative. There's nothing, you know, no other option except to exist in the sort of structure that we're in right now. And so these are good answers back to it, just that new alternatives will arise, that once we shift to a more feminist perspective on foreign policy, and when I say feminist, it doesn't mean just women run the world. That's not at all what I mean. It's just more of a feminist in the sense of the sociologically constructed idea of the female as opposed to the sociologically constructed idea of the male, in which there tends to be more nurturing, there tends to be more of talking consensus as opposed to dictating and ruling. And those are all obviously the socialized characteristics that we associate with male and female, not necessarily the male and the female themselves. And so this is another argument that can work fairly well as critique on the affirmative also, is that, you know, when we do sanctions, when we say, no, you can't be what we want, which is what the affirmative is attempting to change, that we can do it in a way that has more of a feminist perspective than what's happening in the status quo. So you can potentially work this into an affirmative change area also. So, feminist critique of foreign policy. Can you run it with direct instruction? Carrie, yes, why? Okay. I heard somebody say no, I think. That's a potential problem. And the thing with all these critiques is that a lot of times on face they seem very consistent. Because on face I think direct instruction and just a straight up feminist critique of international international relations do seem to be consistent. You know, we want to change the way we do things. But if you get a little bit deeper into literature, you may very well end up with the problems that was mentioned up there, that yes, they're creating the patriarchy as the other, potentially the male as the other. And so there is potentially some tension between them on a rhetorical, maybe not so much on an argument level, but on a rhetorical level, just the language choices that you would use when you were explaining the critique. There's definitely some tension, which is something that you want to think about when you're deciding how to run a critique. Okay, feminist critique, international relations, and shunning. Can you run those together? If you say yes and no, give a reason. Okay, one potential problem with running them together is that shunning is the treating of the other, or it's more of a holding the bully will force you to do what you want them to do. Yes? Okay, more communal policy as opposed to unilateral action. Yeah, I think, and the thing about running critiques, for those of you who raise your hand and say you really love critiques, or for those of you who don't really like running critiques so much that you might not think about, is that in a lot of instances, when people run more than one critique together, a lot of times there are probably philosophical contradictions between the two, just because they're very frequently based on different philosophical assumptions that you examine, there's a tension between the two. So something that you need to think about when you're not only running critiques, but when you're choosing how to answer critiques. You know, how can I use my affirmative and answer this critique back? Why is my affirmative the thing that the critique is advocating, and why are other arguments they're running inconsistent with their own critique? Yes.
Isn't it possible that the feminist critique is actually a critique of the shunning critique itself? I mean, so those are the things that are
yes, and that's a very good point that was brought up down here, is that you can use any one of these critiques that is consistent with another to potentially counter-critique another critique. So if somebody's running shunning, and you've got a fat file on feminist international relations theory, you might be able to use that as a counter-critique to the shunning critique. So those are things to think about also on this topic, just because there are so many critiques that are possible on the topic, and so many critiques that go in so many different ways that are based on such varying philosophical underpinnings, that a lot of times one critique will function as a counter-critique or one level of answer to another critique that somebody else is running. The fourth critique that I wanted to mention is realism. And realism is basically the foreign policy assumption that we've worked within for the last several hundred years. And the whole notion of realism is this idea that realists would argue that in the world, there's always going to be the powerful and the not powerful. And our goal is to become and maintain being powerful. It's based on what political scientists would call balance of power politics. And so the idea is that there's this one power here, like during the Cold War, for example, we have the United States, we have Russia. We were the two big powers, and we balanced each other out since the world was this bipolar world. Half the world was aligning with the United States, half the world was aligning with the Soviet Union, and we kept each other in check. It prevented any type of maybe conflict from happening, et cetera, because of the balance of power that was happening. But since the fall of the Cold War, we're now in a situation where we're no longer having that balance of power, and the world has become somewhat unbalanced and more unipolar because the United States is the only real big power. And so realists argue that we always need to make sure that we have our power, that we maintain our power, that somebody's always going to be trying to usurp our power, because that's how balanced power politics work, is that there's somebody always trying to counteract the power. And so the realist critique is a critique of that notion of foreign relations and foreign policy. And the people who critique the realist perspective of foreign policy, and in some ways, Reconstruction, Feminism and Feminist Critique of IR are kind of very specific critiques of realism in a lot of ways, but there's more general just critique of realism that says the balance of power politics is not how we should look at the world. We shouldn't always be viewing the world as if it's this zero-sum game where if we have power, somebody else can't have power, that there needs to be the dominant power, and somebody's always trying to get us. And so it's the critique, just the more generic critique of that idea of foreign policy. And the way that will probably link to an affirmative case is that, again, constructive engagement, since the only real exemplar that we have of what that means is China, is that the reason we're constructively engaging China is because we perceive, in a lot of ways, that China's going to be the next big power. We beat the Soviet Union, they fell apart, they crumbled, we still got some issues with them, right? Now, this is the realist perspective. And now, the realists are arguing that China's the next big threat, the next thing that could be a counter to our own power, the balance to us. And as a balance of power, the way balance of power politics work and the way the realist assumptions work, say, that's a very, very bad thing. And so we are constructively engaging China in order to prevent them from having that level of power that could be used against us. And so the link into the realism critique, or the critique of realism on the topic, is very likely that what we're going to be attempting to do with our constructive engagement is to bring them into our fold and not let them be powerful. Because if we're trading with them, if we're engaging with them, then it allows us to manipulate them in ways in which we can't if we have sanctions on them. So the idea is we need to change how we function, because part of balance of power politics isn't necessarily just me being this big bad bully on the block and beating up other people. It's also how you use your soft power in order to manipulate, and soft power means things like culture, trade, economics, the things that aren't the military, but how we use soft power in order to manipulate and get people to do what we want, in order to keep them from being something that somebody or some entity that could counter us. And so the critique would be linked off of this notion that what we're doing with constructive engagement is attempting to use more of a soft power approach, but it's really the same realist policies that the sanctions might be. And so a lot of the arguments that you'll probably hear on this topic as answers to the critique, or one answer you'll probably hear frequently, is that, well, plan's better than the status quo, right? Because if you're looking at a critique of realism, sanctions are probably slightly more realist than maybe constructive engagement policy, or at least arguably so. And so you're going to hear that argument a lot. So for those of you who like to run critiques, how do you plan on countering that argument? Because on any of these critiques is going to be an issue that, well, plan's probably slightly less of a link than the status quo. How do you plan on countering that this year? See, hand it in the back. Yeah, which is a really good answer. Could everybody hear that, or do you want me to repeat what he said? What he basically said is that the reason why it's not better than the status quo is that the reason the assumptions behind this all the advocates of people who are supporting the case would be that, what we're doing now isn't working to maintain our power. This is an answer to the realist critique perspective. It's not working, so we're going to change our strategy into another way that allows us to more conveniently co-opt them and to control them. So the idea is, the assumptions behind your authors would be that, well, sanctions isn't a good way to control them, so in order to maintain our balance of power, we'll constructively engage instead. That allows us to better control them. So the assumption is still very realist in its inception, and would be worse because it's attempting to use a more insidious format in order to control them. How else might you answer this argument? Just that, that's what's worse than the case. I'm having trouble hearing you, I'm sorry.
The critique is diverse. The critique is
view of the world is, what our culture is. And so there's likely to be a fairly good ground on this topic, especially just given that three of the countries are traditionally Islamic countries, and there's a lot of tension between Western policies and some elements of the Islamic religion. And I don't want to characterize the Islamic religion as a big monolithic thing that it must be equally the same thing. That's just not true. But there has traditionally been some conflict between our views and the views of at least certain elements of the Islamic population.